they stuck to their guns. Explaining why gave them a chance to affirm their convictions. But when asked to explain how their preferred policies work, they became more moderate. Considering how led them to confront the gaps in their knowledge and realize that some of their extreme views were impractical. To form alliances, originals can temper their radicalism by smuggling their real vision inside a Trojan horse. U.S. Navy Lieutenant Josh Steinman had a grand vision to open the military up to outside technology by creating a Silicon Valley hub. Steinman knew he would face resistance if he presented a radical, sweeping proposal for rethinking the Navy's entire approach to innovation. So he led with a more tempered pitch. He presented some new technology for doing real-time updates in the air to Admiral Jonathan Greenert, the Chief of Naval Operations. Intrigued, Admiral Greenert asked what would come next, and Rear Admiral Scott Sterney threw a softball question at Steinman, inquiring about how the military should think about the technical future. "That's when we threw the strike," Steinman recalls. "Sir, the future is going to be about software, not hardware, and we need an entity of the U.S. Navy in Silicon Valley." A few months later, after other junior officers made similar cases about the importance of software, the CNO gave a speech advocating for the idea, which also circulated around the Pentagon. Not long afterward, the Secretary of Defense announced an embassy in Silicon Valley. Steinman leveraged what psychologist Robert Cialdini calls the foot-in-the-door technique, where you lead with a small request to secure an initial commitment before revealing the larger one. By opening with a moderate ask instead of a radical one, Steinman gained allies. Coalitions often fall apart when people refuse to moderate their radicalism. That was one of the major failures of the Occupy Wall Street movement, a protest against economic and social inequality that began in 2011. That year, polls showed that the majority of Americans supported the movement, but it soon fell apart. Activist Serja Popovich marvels that its extreme positioning alienated most of its potential allies. Its fatal error, he argues, was naming the movement after the radical tactic of camping out, which few people find attractive. He believes that had the group simply relabeled itself the 99%, it might still exist. The Occupy name implied that the only way you could belong was if you dropped everything you were doing and started occupying something, Popovich writes. Occupying is still just a single weapon in the enormous arsenal of peaceful protest, and more to the point, one that tends to invite only a certain type of dedicated person. Movements, which are always fighting uphill battles, need to draw in more casual participants if they are to succeed. The 99% is inclusive. It invites everyone to get involved and to use their own preferred tactics. By tempering the brand of the movement and broadening its methods, it might have been possible to gain the support of more mainstream citizens. In the women's suffrage movement, this is where the narcissism of small differences reared its ugly head. When Anthony and Stanton partnered with the racist George Francis Train in 1867, Stone wrote that Train's support of suffrage was enough to condemn it in the minds of all persons not already convinced. And her husband warned Anthony that the alliance would mean irreparable harm to the cause of votes for women and blacks. A longtime ally, William Lloyd Garrison, begged Anthony to back away. "In all friendliness, and with the highest regard for the women's rights movement, I cannot refrain from expressing my regret and astonishment that you and Mrs. Stanton should have taken leave of such good sense as to be traveling companions and associate lecturers with that crack-brained harlequin and semi-lunatic George Francis Train. You will only subject yourselves to merited ridicule and condemnation, and turn the movement which you aim to promote into unnecessary contempt. He may be of use in drawing an audience, but so would a kangaroo, a gorilla, or a hippopotamus." But Anthony would not budge from her radical conviction that if women couldn't gain the right to vote, blacks shouldn't either. She campaigned with Train throughout Kansas and accepted his funding to create a suffrage newspaper. When Stone confronted her about tarnishing the reputation of their Equal Rights Association by linking it to Train, Anthony became defensive. "I know what is the matter with you. It is envy and spleen and hate, because I have a paper and you have not." Stanton sided with Anthony, endorsing her decision to partner with Train. "It would be right and wise to accept aid from the devil himself," she said, "provided that he did not tempt us to lower our standard." The alliance proved costly. Kansas had a chance to become the first state to adopt suffrage, but ended up losing the vote, and the black suffrage proposal lost as well. Many insiders held the alliance with Train accountable for both defeats. A couple years later, when Stanton and Anthony had formed their own association, instead of learning from the mistakes of the past, they refused to moderate their extreme stance when anyone who supported suffrage was a friend. Forming another alliance that cast a dark cloud over the movement, Stanton joined forces with Victoria Woodhull, an activist who became the first woman to run for the American presidency, but undermined the suffrage movement with a radical agenda. Woodhull, whose past included time as a prostitute and a charlatan healer, advocated for sexual freedom, proclaiming that she had an inalienable constitutional and natural right to love whom I may, to love as long or as short a period as I can, to change that love every day if I please. Suffrage opponents used Woodhull's position as evidence that the movement was really about sexual promiscuity rather than voting rights. Members withdrew in large numbers from Anthony and Stanton's organization, to the point that they couldn't even gather sufficient attendance for a convention. Even supportive legislators advised suffragists to put their quest for the vote aside. Suffragists remarked that Woodhull's campaign is the most efficient agent employed to frighten people from our ranks and set the cause back 20 years. The alliance precipitated a storm of criticism so severe, Anthony's biographer would later write, that it made the prior attacks look like a summer shower to a Missouri cyclone. In maintaining the alliance with Woodhull, Stanton failed to recognize the value of tempered radicalism. She drove Stone and many other past and potential allies away by overlooking the dramatic differences in how insiders and outsiders judge coalitions. Her error is illuminated in a new study by management researchers Blake Ashforth and Peter Reingen, who find that insiders and outsiders have distinct ideas about who represents a coalition. For insiders, the key representative is the person who is most central and connected in the group. For the suffragists, that was clearly Stanton and Anthony. But for outsiders, the person who represents the group is the one with the most extreme views. That was Woodhull. Her personal scandal overshadowed the suffrage cause and alienated many who were open to the relatively moderate idea of voting rights, but not the more radical ideas of sexual independence for women. As outsiders judge the suffrage movement by the extreme company Anthony and Stanton kept, Stone had little choice but to distance her organization further from their efforts. Enemies make better allies than frenemies. In The Godfather Part II, Michael Corleone advises, "Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer." But what should we do about people who don't fall neatly into either category? Typically, we view our relationships on a continuum from positive to negative. Our closest friends have our backs. Our greatest enemies are actively working against us. But research shows that we need to draw two independent axes, one for how positive a relationship is, and a separate one for how negative the relationship is. Along with purely positive and wholly negative relationships, we can have connections that are both positive and negative. Psychologists call them ambivalent relationships. You might know them as frenemies, people who sometimes support you and sometimes undermine you. Stone's relationships with both Stanton and Anthony were deeply ambivalent. They had been both allies and adversaries. On the one hand, she admired Stanton's wit and Anthony's industriousness, and they had a proven record of productive collaboration. On the other hand, Stone objected to their lunatic friends and wild alliances, which threatened the respectability of the women's suffrage movement. And Anthony and Stanton had a pattern of duplicity. They signed Stone's name to an ad complimenting their racist benefactor without her permission. More recently, Stone had written to Stanton in the fall of 1869 proposing the hearty, active cooperation of all the friends of the cause, better than either could do alone, and assuring her that Stone's organization shall never be an enemy or antagonist of yours. Yet at the convention launching Stone's group, Anthony attempted an ill-fated coup to elect Stanton as president. Stone invited her to the podium, and Anthony concluded by accusing Stone of attempting to nullify and crush out her organization. In 1872, Stanton reached out to Stone with a proposal for reconciliation, urging her to let bygones be bygones, let all personalities be buried in the work that is before us. Stone took some conciliatory steps, sharing Stanton's articles and speeches in her newspaper. Then came a letter from Anthony proposing to cooperate and make a systematic campaign, inviting Stone to Rochester to settle the question that we are all together as one grand woman. Stone declined. With the benefit of hindsight, it's easy to judge Stone's refusal as a stubborn mistake. Had she accepted, the organizations might have won the right to vote years earlier. But if you examine how ambivalent relationships affect our stress levels, you will find some wisdom in Stone's resistance. To discover the most effective way to handle ambivalent relationships, Michelle Duffy, a management professor at the University of Minnesota, led a study surveying police officers on how often they were undermined and supported by their closest coworker, as well as their levels of stress and absence from work. Not surprisingly, negative relationships were stressful. When officers felt undermined by their closest coworker, they were less committed, took more unauthorized breaks, and were absent from work more often. What happened when the undermining colleague was also supportive at times? Things didn't get better, they got worse. Being undermined and supported by the same person meant even lower commitment and more work missed. The good news is that when officers were undermined by one person but supported by a different person, they were better off. Support from a colleague or a supervisor had a buffering effect, protecting officers against the stress and absences that undermining otherwise caused. Negative relationships are unpleasant, but they're predictable. If a colleague consistently undermines you, you can keep your distance and expect the worst. But when you're dealing with an ambivalent relationship, you're constantly on guard, grappling with questions about when that person can actually be trusted. As Duffy's team explains, it takes more emotional energy and coping resources to deal with individuals who are inconsistent. In a series of groundbreaking studies, psychologist Bert Uccino found that ambivalent relationships are literally unhealthier than negative relationships. In one study, having more ambivalent relationships predicted higher rates of stress, depression, and dissatisfaction with life. In another, older adults rated their relationships with the 10 most important people in their lives and completed 2 anxiety-provoking tasks, delivering a speech with little preparation and taking a rapid-fire math test. The more ambivalent relationships the participants had, the more their heart rate spiked on both tasks. Lucy Stone understood the risks of forming alliances with ambivalent ties. In 1871, she wrote that it was best not to strike hands with these people. They were our late enemies. We don't know that they are our friends. American studies expert and biographer Andrea Moore Kerr notes that Stone was unable to predict or control the behavior of either Stanton or Anthony. In response, according to Baker, Stone sought to keep her organization free from infection by the dreaded incubus of the Stanton-Anthony forces. Our instinct is to sever our bad relationships and salvage the ambivalent ones. But the evidence suggests we ought to do the opposite. Cut our frenemies and attempt to convert our enemies. In efforts to challenge the status quo, originals often ignore their opponents. If someone is already resisting a change, the logic goes, there's no point in wasting your time on him. Instead, focus on strengthening your ties with people who already support you. But our best allies aren't the people who have supported us all along. They're the ones who started out against us and then came around to our side. Half a century ago, eminent psychologist Elliot Aronson conducted a series of experiments suggesting that we're often more sensitive to gains and losses in esteem than the level of esteem itself. When someone always supports us, we take it for granted and can discount it. But we regard someone who began as a rival and then became an enthusiastic supporter as an authentic advocate. A person whose liking for us increases over time will be liked better than one who has always liked us, Aronson explains. We find it more rewarding when someone's initially negative feelings toward us gradually become positive than if that person's feelings for us were entirely positive all along. While we'll have an especially strong affinity toward our converted rivals, will they feel the same way toward us? Yes. This is the second advantage of converting resistors. To like us, they have to work especially hard to overcome their initial negative impressions, telling themselves, "I must have been wrong about that person." Moving forward, to avoid the cognitive dissonance of changing their minds yet again, they'll be especially motivated to maintain a positive relationship. Third, and most important, it is our former adversaries who are the most effective at persuading others to join our movements. They can marshal better arguments on our behalf because they understand the doubts and misgivings of resistors and fence-sitters. And they're a more credible source because they haven't just been Pollyanna followers or yes-men all along. In one of Aronson's studies, people were most persuaded to change their opinions by those who had started out negative and then become more positive. And more recently, corporate executives were subtly influenced by board members who argued with them initially and then conformed, which signals that their opinion appears to stand up to critical scrutiny. Of course, not every negative relationship can be turned around. Essayist Chuck Cloisterman draws an important distinction between ordinary nemeses, adversaries who might become allies, and arch-enemies. You kind of like your nemesis, despite the fact that you despise him. If your nemesis invited you out for cocktails, you would accept the offer. But you would never have drinks with your arch-enemy, unless you were attempting to spike his gin with hemlock. Instead of avoiding her enemies, Lucy Stone sought them out and actively engaged with them. She helped convert Julia Ward Howe, a prominent poet who wrote The Battle Hymn of the Republic. Howe had been invited to attend a suffrage meeting and came only reluctantly, with a rebellious heart, regarding Stone as one of her dislikes. But after listening to Stone's speech, Howe became a close ally and one of the great leaders of the movement. In 1855, a heckler disrupted a convention by describing suffragists as unfit for marriage, disparaging the movement as a few disappointed women. Instead of ignoring him, Lucy Stone addressed him directly in her speech, and the audience roared with applause. The last speaker alluded to this movement as being that of a few disappointed women. "From the first years to which my memory stretches, I have been a disappointed woman. I was disappointed when I came to seek a profession. Every employment was closed to me except those of the teacher, the seamstress, and the housekeeper. In education, in marriage, in religion, in everything, Disappointment is the lot of women. It shall be the business of my life to deepen this disappointment in every woman's heart until she bows down to it no longer. When Stone walked around hanging up posters announcing abolition speeches, young men often followed her and ripped them down. Stone asked them if they loved their mothers. Absolutely. Did they love their sisters? Of course. She explained that in the South, men their own age were sold as slaves and would never see their families again. As Kerr explains, she then invited them to attend the evening's lectures as her special guests. Such street recruits proved useful allies, able to defuse other troublemakers. In 1859, a college student named Frances Willard wrote in her journal that Lucy Stone was in town and noted, "I don't like her views." Given her own conservative opinions, Willard joined the temperance movement, but years later became one of the most influential suffrage leaders. She reflected that Stone was a force behind her change of heart. "I remember when I was dreadfully afraid of Susan, and of Lucy, too. But now I love and honor these women, and I cannot put into words my sense of what it means to have the blessings of these women who have made it possible for more timid ones like myself to come along and take our places in the world's work. If they had not blazed the trees and pioneered the way, we should not have dared to come." In 1876, Willard led the effort to align suffragists with temperance workers. Research would later show that over the next two decades, every time Willard visited a state, the odds of a suffrage-temperance alliance spiked. How did she convince the conservative WCTU members to partner with the liberal suffragists? A clue to her success can be found in Hollywood, where movies live and die based on how well writers can persuade executives to buy into their visions. Familiar makes the heart grow fonder. In the early 1990s, a group of screenwriters proposed something that had never been done at Disney. They wanted to make an animated movie based on an original concept. Departing from a half-century of hits with time-honored tales like Cinderella and Snow White, they set out to write a fresh story from scratch. Studio chief Jeffrey Katzenberg was skeptical, telling colleagues it was an experiment. "No one had any confidence in it," director Rob Minkoff recalls. "It was seen as the B-movie at Disney." The script eventually became The Lion King, which was the highest-grossing film of 1994. Winning two Oscars and a Golden Globe. Katzenberg had said he would get down on his knees in appreciation if it brought in $50 million. By 2014, it had earned over $1 billion. Like many original ideas, the movie almost never got off the ground. It was conceived as Bambi in Africa with lions instead of deer as the protagonists. But after the first script failed, five of the writers gathered to rethink it. They sat together for 2 days, batting around ideas and weaving an epic tale about the succession of kings, and then pitched the story to a group of Disney executives. The first to respond was CEO Michael Eisner, who wasn't getting it. Grasping for a hook, he asked, "Could you make this into King Lear?" Coincidentally, Minkoff had reread that Shakespeare play a few weeks earlier, and he explained why the concept didn't fit. Then, from the back of the room, a producer named Maureen Donnelly raised another Shakespearean suggestion. "No, this is Hamlet." Suddenly, everyone got it. There was a collective sigh of recognition, Minkoff says. Of course it was Hamlet. The uncle kills the father, and the son has to avenge his father's death. So then we decided it was going to be Hamlet with lions. In that pivotal moment, the film got the green light. To understand what saved the movie from the cutting room floor, I turned to Justin Berg, the creativity expert at Stanford. The writers had to begin with lions, Berg explains. Had they started with Hamlet, they would have ended up with an animated knockoff of Shakespeare. Beginning with a novel template was the key to originality, but it also posed a challenge. In an experiment, Berg asked people to design a new product to help college students succeed in job interviews. He instructed them to start with the familiar concept of a three-ring binder and then come up with something novel. Bookstore managers and customers rated the resulting ideas as utterly conventional. According to Berg, the starting point in generating ideas is like the first brushstroke that a painter lays down on a canvas. It shapes the path for the rest of the painting, constraining what we imagine. Beginning with a three-ring binder led Berg's participants down the path of proposing obvious products, like a folder with pockets for resumes and business cards, hardly a game-changing idea. To come up with something original, we need to begin from a more unfamiliar place. Instead of the three-ring binder, Berg gave some participants a more novel starting point, an inline skate for rollerblading. They were no longer captives of the conventional. They generated ideas that scored 37% higher in originality. One participant observed that during job interviews, it's often difficult to know how much time has passed, and you don't want to appear rude by looking at your watch, breaking eye contact with the interviewer. The proposed solution was to build a watch that tracks time by touch, with physical elements like the wheels on roller skates that change shape or texture as time passes. Although a novel starting point does help foster the originality of our ideas, it doesn't necessarily make them palatable and practical to our audiences. While the rollerblade led to a creative idea for subtly tracking time, squeezing your watch is an odd behavior. To solve this problem, Berg gave people the novel starting point of the inline skate, but added a twist. After they developed their ideas, he showed them a picture of products that people typically use in job interviews, then asked them to spend a few additional minutes refining their concepts. For the person who wanted a polite method of timekeeping, this made all the difference. Instead of a watch that tells time by touch, after taking a look at the kinds of products that were familiar in job interviews, the same inventor designed a pen that tells time by touch. The most promising ideas begin from novelty and then add familiarity, which capitalizes on the mere exposure effect we covered earlier. On average, a novel starting point followed by a familiarity infusion led to ideas that were judged as 14% more practical without sacrificing any originality. As Berg points out, if you started the experiment with a pen rather than an inline skate, you'd probably end up with something a lot like a conventional pen. But by starting with something unexpected in the context of job interviews, like an inline skate, and then incorporating the familiarity of a pen, you can develop an idea that is both novel and useful. In the case of The Lion King, that is what happened when Maureen Donnelly suggested that the script could be like Hamlet. The dose of familiarity helped the executives connect the novel Savannah script to a classic tale. It gives a large group of people a single point of reference, Minkoff explains. With absolute originality, you can lose people. Executives have to sell it, so they're looking for those handles. It gives them something to hang on to. The Lion King team went on to take a cue from Hamlet. Realizing that they needed a to-be-or-not-to-be moment, they added a scene in which the baboon, Rafiki, delivers a lesson to Simba about the importance of remembering who he is. In the women's suffrage movement, temperance workers didn't come on board until an emerging leader offered a familiarity infusion. Vanderbilt sociologist Holly McCammon identified two main arguments that suffragists used in their quest to earn the right to vote: justice and societal reform. The justice argument focused on fairness, emphasizing that women had the unalienable right to vote. The societal reform argument focused on social good, highlighting how women's nurturing, domestic, and moral qualities would improve the country. At the time, the justice argument was considered the radical one, as it violated traditional gender role stereotypes by proposing that women and men were equals in all domains. The societal reform argument was more moderate, as it affirmed gender role stereotypes, in suggesting that the unique qualities conservatives already valued in private life could also contribute to public life. In a form of public motherhood, enfranchised women could benefit society by promoting education, limiting government corruption, and helping the poor. When McCammon and colleagues coded suffrage speeches, newspaper columns, banners, and leaflets that were produced over the course of a quarter century, the justice argument appeared earliest and most frequently. Overall, suffragists wielded the justice case 30% of the time, compared with barely more than half that often for the societal reform argument. But justice arguments fell on deaf ears with the WCTU members, who clung to traditional gender roles and rejected the notion that women were the equals of men. The societal reform argument also failed to resonate with familiar values. Conservative temperance workers were aiming for stability, not change. It was Francis Willard, now an emerging WCTU leader, who ingeniously reframed the pitch and made it widely acceptable. How the West was won. Francis Willard didn't use the justice argument or the societal reform argument. She didn't even present the issue as a suffrage ballot. Instead, she called it a home protection ballot. Willard saw suffrage as a weapon of protection from the tyranny of drink. Likening the ballot to a powerful sunglass, she promised to use it to burn and blaze on the saloon till it shrivels up and in lurid vapors curls away like mist. Protecting the home was a familiar goal for the WCTU members. Now, suffrage could be used as a means to a desirable end. If temperance advocates wanted to fight alcohol abuse, they needed to vote. As Baker writes, it was an indirect approach to suffrage made on the religious grounds of protecting the home, but it linked the two most powerful women's reform movements in the United States. Suffrage, a universal entitlement required in the minds of Anthony and Stanton on the grounds of natural rights, was a tool for Willard, a tactical appeal to domestic women. When McCammon led a study of four decades of alliances between the WCTU and suffragists, the data showed that after suffragists made the justice argument in a particular state, there was no increase in the likelihood of an alliance with the WCTU in that state the following year. In fact, an alliance became slightly less likely. But once suffragists presented the home protection framing, the odds of joining forces with the WCTU in that state increased significantly, as did the odds that a state would eventually pass suffrage. Willard's home protection argument consistently moved the needle, but just how far depended on timing. She had the biggest impact when the WCTU was under threat. When she visited states after prohibition legislation failed or saloons became more widespread, WCTU coalitions with suffragists were the most likely. The conservative WCTU members felt that their mission was at risk and began to see suffrage as a valuable weapon in their war against alcohol abuse. Willard helped WCTU members make sense of their political defeats by interpreting them to be the results of political weakness, McCammon and a colleague explain. By convincing WCTU members that women's voting rights could help win prohibition laws, Willard aligned WCTU thinking with that of the suffragists. Ultimately, Willard's leadership enabled women to gain full voting rights in several states and school board election voting rights in 19 states. This argument was particularly effective in the West. Before the 19th Amendment to the Constitution gave women full voting rights, 81% of the Western states and territories passed suffrage laws, compared with only 2 in the East and 0 in the South. It's highly unlikely that Frances Willard would have started the women's suffrage movement. Justin Berg's research suggests that if women had begun with the familiar goal of protecting their homes they might never have considered the vote. Radical thinking is often necessary to put an original stake in the ground. But once the radical idea of voting was planted, the original suffragists needed a more tempered mediator to reach a wider audience. Frances Willard had unique credibility with the temperance activists because she drew upon comfortably familiar ideas in her speeches. She made heavy use of religious rhetoric, quoting regularly from the Bible. Frances Willard was the quintessential tempered radical. "Under Willard, nothing seemed radical," writes Baker, even as she was moving toward more progressive causes. Her actions offer two lessons about persuading potential partners to join forces. First, we need to think differently about values. Instead of assuming that others share our principles or trying to convince them to adopt ours, we ought to present our values as a means of pursuing theirs. It's hard to change other people's ideals. It's much easier to link our agendas to familiar values that people already hold. Second, just as we saw in the case of Meredith Perry's disguising her real objective of creating wireless power, transparency isn't always the best policy. As much as they want to be straightforward with potential partners, originals occasionally need to reframe their ideas to appeal to their audience. Willard smuggled the vote inside the Trojan horse of fighting alcohol abuse. But that argument didn't work with every group she addressed. The justice argument attracted the most radical women to the cause, as they favored equal gender roles. With the highly conservative temperance activists, the most tempered argument for home protection cemented coalitions. But for converting other allies to actually join the suffrage movement, the home protection argument was too tempered. McCammon's research shows that to convert more women to believe in suffrage as an end, not simply as a means to other ends, a Goldilocks pitch was necessary, the moderate societal reform argument. For movement leaders to succeed in organizing potential recruits, they must strike the appropriate balance between resonating with the existing cultural repertoire and challenging the status quo. Membership in state suffrage organizations didn't change after suffragists framed their issue in terms of justice or home protection, but it spiked after they accentuated how women could improve society, and so did the passage of suffrage laws. Originality is what everybody wants, but there's a sweet spot, Rob Minkoff explains. If it's not original enough, it's boring or trite. If it's too original, it may be hard for the audience to understand. The goal is to push the envelope, not tear the envelope. Throughout her life, Lucy Stone continued to reference justice and equality when speaking to women who were already involved in the suffrage movement. But when addressing audiences of outsiders, she was more careful to incorporate the societal reform argument and respect traditional gender roles. In 1853, when an unruly audience interrupted the proceedings of a women's rights convention, Stone took the platform. Instead of leading with justice, she affirmed the contributions of women in the domestic sphere. "I think that any woman who stands on the throne of her own house, dispensing there the virtues of love, charity, and peace, and sends out of it into the world good men who may help to make the world better, occupies a higher position than any crowned head." She suggested that women could contribute more and described how they were entering professions, taking care not to compare them to men. When she mentioned a woman who became a minister, the audience hissed, and Stone again reminded the audience that she supported women's domestic roles. "Some men hiss who had no mothers to teach them better." United We Stand, Creating Coalitions Across Conflict Lines. After two decades of conflict, the two suffrage organizations finally began to converge in philosophy and tactics. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony had avoided radical alliances for more than a decade, and they were now investing their energy in educating the public. Stanton led the writing of a history of the movement. Anthony traveled around the country to lecture and lobby, and saw eye to eye with Lucy Stone on the value of an alliance with temperance workers, and a more moderate campaign focusing solely on suffrage rather than other women's issues. Years ago, when studying the conflict between Israel and Palestine, Harvard psychologist Herbert Kelman observed that conflicts between two groups are often caused and intensified by conflicts within the groups. Although Stone's organization was aligned on the benefits of reuniting, there was strife within Anthony and Stanton's organization. Stanton objected to the alliances with temperance workers and the limited focus on suffrage. Various members questioned whether suffrage should be enacted at the state or federal levels, and whether it should be full or partial. As effective as Stone was in converting allies, she was the wrong person to negotiate with Anthony. When distrust runs as deep as it did between these two women, coalitions depend on the warring individuals serving not as leaders, but as lightning rods. As Blake Ashforth and Peter Reingen write, this could have allowed members of each organization to blame the divisiveness of competition on Stanton's radical stance, so that each side could blame conflict more on the other side's firebrands, while setting the stage for them to cooperate with other members of the rival group. To build coalitions across conflict lines, Kelman finds that it's rarely effective to send hawks to negotiate. You need the doves in each group to sit down, listen to each other's perspectives, identify their common goals and methods, and engage in joint problem-solving. In 1990, Kelman brought together a series of influential leaders from Israel and Palestine for a series of unofficial workshops, meeting regularly over 3 years. A typical workshop involved between 3 and 6 representatives from each country, along with 2 to 4 facilitators. The representatives shared their perspectives, avoiding blaming each other and justifying their own views, and focusing on analyzing the effects of their interaction on the conflict. After all participants expressed their concerns and understood and acknowledged those posed by everyone else, they embarked on joint problem solving. Shortly after the workshops ended in 1993, the Oslo Accords were signed. It was the first time the Israeli government and the Palestine Liberation Organization had reached a face-to-face agreement. The leaders won the Nobel Peace Prize for it, and insiders credited Kelman's efforts as a catalyst. Stone and Anthony recognized the value of removing the hawks from the discussion, deciding to each designate 7 members of their organizations to a joint committee that would negotiate the terms of a unification agreement. But the principles laid out by Stone and Anthony were not sufficient to create a foundation for consensus, as the committee from Anthony's organization experienced such discord that they had to appoint a separate 8-member committee to help them. When they finally reached consensus, their proposal fell so far outside the scope of the agreed-upon principles that Stone's committee lacked the authority to decide on it. In 1890, 3 years into the effort to reunite, Stone recognized the challenges of solidarity and the value of passing the torch. The younger ones want to unite, and the old ones who remember the causes of division will soon be gone. Her daughter and husband successfully negotiated the terms of an alliance with Anthony's committee, and their organizations merged. For her part, Anthony came to understand the value of tempered radicalism, to the point that Stanton complained, "Lucy and Susan alike see suffrage only. They do not see religious and social bondage. Neither do the young women in either association. Hence, they may as well combine, for they have only one mind and one purpose." Although Anthony and Stanton never mended fences with Stone, when Stone passed away, the sheer force of her contributions compelled them to speak glowingly of her. "There is none more winning than Lucy Stone," Anthony declared. "We have never had a woman in our whole 50 years of this movement who could go before an audience and melt the heart of everyone in it like that woman. She stood alone." In Stanton's eyes, the death of no woman in America had ever called out so general a tribute of public respect and esteem. Stone was the first who really stirred the nation's heart on the subject of women's wrongs, and their disagreement many years earlier was because Stone felt the slave's wrongs more deeply than her own. My philosophy was more egotistical. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, philosopher George Santayana wrote. That would prove to hold true for the American women's suffrage movement on at least two occasions. In 1890, two members of Anthony's organization, furious at her scheming to create a national organization and the move toward tempered radicalism, split off to form a rival group that attacked the efforts to unify. Anthony and Stanton quashed it, but they were not around to warn their successors against the narcissism of small differences. At the turn of the 20th century, in the twilight of their lives, they handed the leadership of the National Suffrage Organization on to Carrie Chapman Catt, then a temperance activist and WCTU member. But a more radical woman named Alice Paul, not content to pursue suffrage with tempered tactics like lecturing, writing, and lobbying, favored bolder actions. She embarked on a hunger strike and rejected Catt's nonpartisan position, blaming the Democratic Party for the failure to grant suffrage. Paul's actions were so radical that she was expelled from the National Suffrage Organization, and she formed her own in 1916. As of 1918, the national organization boasted over 1 million members. Paul's had only 10,000, and like her predecessors, she avoided alliances with African Americans. Her group picketed the White House and ridiculed President Woodrow Wilson, which might have helped to move the needle. But it was Catt's leadership, progressive but not radical, that finally led Wilson to throw his support behind the amendment, one onlooker wrote. In her dying breath in 1893, Lucy Stone whispered 4 words to her daughter: "Make the world better." It would be 27 more years before the 19th Amendment passed. But when women gained full voting rights nationwide, Stone's footprint of tempered radicalism was powerful and visible. As Kerr sums it up, the organizational model Stone provided would be adopted by Carrie Chapman Catt in the final successful march to an amendment in 1920. Chapter 6. Rebel with a Cause. How Siblings, Parents, and Mentors Nurture Originality. We are not our brother's keeper. In countless large and small ways, we are our brother's maker. Harry and Bonaro Overstreet. A moment ago, he was standing calmly on third base, adjusting his hat. Now his feet are darting side to side, dancing away from the bag. He is poised for a head start toward home plate. He is one of the greatest men ever to set foot on a baseball diamond, and he has been in this position before. 4 previous times he has led his team to the World Series, and all 4 times they have lost to the Yankees. This time, he hopes, will be different. It's the opening game of his 5th championship battle against the Yankees, and his team is down 6-4 in the 8th inning. With 2 outs, he has a dilemma. Should he count on his teammate to drive him in, or go for broke and try to steal home? Stealing a base is one of the riskiest moves in baseball. It increases your team's odds of scoring by less than 3%, and to do it successfully, you usually need to slide into the base, which can mean a painful physical collision with a fielder. Stealing home is even riskier. Instead of having his back to you, as would be the case if you were trying to steal second or third base, the pitcher is already facing the plate, allowing for an easy throw. The pitcher has to hurl the ball only 60 feet through the air. You have to travel 90 feet by foot. In essence, you have to outrun the ball. And even if you think you can make it, your odds of getting injured are quadrupled at home plate compared to collisions at other bases. In the entire 2012 season, only 3 players attempted to steal home. Although baseball's all-time steals leader, Ricky Henderson, stole more than 1,400 bases in his career. Only one was a pure steal of home plate. In second place all-time for career steals is Lou Brock, whose 938 successful attempts include a grand total of 0 times stealing home. This man, though, is different. He holds the record for stealing home plate more than any player in the modern era, 19 times. Over nearly a century, there are just 2 other players who have even reached double digits. He has led the league in stolen bases twice, but if you believe his decision to steal home is about speed, think again. At 36, he is well past his prime. He has missed a third of the regular season due to injuries. 6 years earlier, he stole 37 bases in a season. In the past 2 seasons combined, he has barely stolen half that many. His hair is silver, and he has put on weight. Sports writers are calling him the old gray fat man. In the past, he has batted 4th, the coveted cleanup spot. Now he is down to 7th in the batting order. He will retire the following year. The man's speed is a relic of the past, but he has spent his whole life taking action where others stood still, and he is not about to stop now. He waits for the right opportunity and then charges ahead. Just as he slides into home plate, the catcher reaches out to tag him. There's nothing certain about the decision, but when the umpire makes the call, he's safe. Ultimately, it's too little, too late. His team loses the first game to the Yankees. But his effort serves a symbolic purpose. In the words of one sports historian, stealing home gives his team a huge psychological lift. The man himself notices it too. Whether it was because of my stealing home or not, the team had new fire. They go on to win the series, landing the coveted championship. Years later, reflecting on the player's legacy, one journalist wrote that his attempts to steal home plate certainly were, collectively, the second boldest thing he ever did in baseball. The first was breaking the color barrier. To become original, we have to be willing to take some risks. When we go against the grain to upend time-honored traditions, we can never be certain that we'll succeed. As journalist Robert Quillen wrote, progress always involves risk. You can't steal second and keep one foot on first base. From the day that Jackie Robinson became Major League Baseball's first black player in 1947, he braved racist peers who refused to play with or against him, opponents who deliberately cut him with their spiked cleats, and hate mail and death threats. He went on to become the first black vice president of a major American company, and the country's first black baseball announcer. What gave him the courage to rebel against social norms and stay resolute in the face of emotional, social, and physical risks? We can observe some clues in an unlikely place by examining the family backgrounds of ballplayers who have shared his penchant for stealing bases. In the modern era of baseball, since the 162-game season was introduced, only 10 players have stolen at least 70 bases in 2 different seasons. Listen to this list. Do you see a pattern? Baseball player, Ricky Henderson. Steals, 130, 108. Birthplace, Chicago, Illinois. Birth order and children and family, 4 of 7. Lou Brock, 118, 74. El Dorado, Arkansas, 7 of 9. Vince Coleman, 110, 109. Jacksonville, Florida, 1 of 1. Maury Wills, 104, 94. Washington, D.C., 7 of 13. Ron LaFleur, 97, 78. Detroit, Michigan, 3 of 4. Omar Moreno, 96, 77. Puerto Armuelles, Panama, 8 of 10. Tim Raines, 90, 78. Sanford, Florida, 5 of 7. Willie Wilson, 83, 79, Montgomery, Alabama, 1 of 1. Marquise Grissom, 78, 76, Atlanta, Georgia, 14 of 15. Kenny Lofton, 75, 70, East Chicago, Indiana, 1 of 1. Aiming to determine why some baseball players steal more bases than others, historian of science Frank Sulloway and psychologist Richard Zweigenhaft did something clever. They identified more than 400 brothers who played professional baseball, which enabled them to compare individuals from the same families, who shared half their DNA and had similar upbringings. Their results revealed a striking fact. Birth order predicted which brother tried to steal more bases. Younger brothers were 10.6 times more likely than their older siblings to attempt to steal a base. The younger brothers weren't necessarily better players overall. They had no advantage when it came to batting average, for example. And comparing brothers who were pitchers, the older siblings actually had a slight edge in ball control. They tended to have more strikeouts and fewer walks. The key difference was the propensity to take risks. Along with attempting more steals, younger brothers were 4.7 times more likely to get hit by a pitch, probably because they dared more often to crowd the plate. But they didn't just take bolder action. They also succeeded more often than their older siblings. Younger brothers were 3.2 times more likely to steal a base safely. In fact, their appetite for risk makes younger siblings less likely even to play baseball. Across 24 different studies of more than 8,000 people, laterborns were 1.48 times more likely to participate in sports with high injury rates, such as football, rugby, boxing, ice hockey, gymnastics, scuba diving, downhill skiing and ski jumping, bobsledding, and auto racing. Firstborns preferred safer sports, baseball, golf, tennis, track, cycling, and crew. When laterborns do opt to play professional baseball, they tend to tear up the base path. Look at the three players who tower over their peers as the reigning home plate thieves of the modern era. All had at least three older siblings. Jackie Robinson, who has been called the father of modern base stealing, was the youngest of five children. The second highest tally for stealing home in the modern era belongs to Rod Carew, the fourth of five children. Beyond having an acute sense of timing, it also takes a certain amount of nerve, Carew noted. To steal home, he explained, I could not have any fear within myself of getting hurt, and I didn't because I felt in control. The third-ranked, Paul Molitor, called stealing home a courage play. He's the fourth child of eight. A similar pattern emerges in the base-stealing rankings listed earlier. Of the only 10 players ever to steal at least 70 bases in two different seasons, half have at least four older siblings, and seven have at least two older siblings. These seven stealing champs are, on average, child number 6.9 in their families, and 71% of their siblings are older than them. Laterborns aren't just more likely to take risks in baseball. The difference also shows up in politics and science, with serious implications for social and intellectual progress. In a landmark study, Sulloway analyzed more than 24 major scientific revolutions and breakthroughs, from Copernican astronomy to Darwinian evolution, and from Newton's mechanics to Einstein's relativity. He enlisted over 100 historians of science to evaluate the stances of nearly 4,000 scientists on a spectrum from extreme support of prevailing views to extreme advocacy of new ideas. Then he tracked the role of birth order in predicting whether the scientists would defend the status quo or champion a revolutionary new theory. In each case, he controlled for the fact that there are more laterborns than firstborns in the population, as well as for social class, family size, and other factors that might influence the results. Compared to firstborns, laterborn scientists had more than triple the odds of enduring